the thinker they made into a flower. I found Thérèse de Lisieux, the way you often find important people, by accident, in a footnote, while looking for something else entirely. The footnote mentioned her trial of faith, one of those phrases religious writers use so often it stops meaning anything. But the quotation attached to it caught me off guard. It didn't sound like someone being pious. It sounded like someone sitting alone in a room, waiting for an answer that wasn't coming, and starting to suspect it never would. That was the first small disturbance. If this was sainthood, it was strangely unhelpful. And if this was unhelpful, why had anyone bothered to save it? Marie-Françoise Thérèse Martin was born in 1873 in Alençon, France, the youngest of 9 children, though only 5 survived infancy. By 15, she had talked her way into a Carmelite convent, an enclosed order where nuns spent their lives in prayer, silence, and manual work behind walls they'd never leave. She died there 9 years later, at 24, of tuberculosis. During her final years, she wrote extensively at her superior's request, filling notebooks with what became known as a story of a soul. After her death, her writings were edited, copied, circulated. Within decades, she had become one of the most popular saints in Catholic history. In 1997, Pope John II declared her a Doctor of the Church, one of the only 4 women ever given that title, placing her theological authority alongside Augustine and Aquinas. The version of Thérèse that most people know is sweet, small, and unthreatening. She's called the little flower. Prayer cards show her holding roses. She is the patron saint of florists, of missionaries, of people who've lost their parents. But when you actually read what she wrote, not the summaries, not the devotional excerpts, but the manuscripts themselves, something else appears. Something considerably less comfortable. The first thing you notice once you start reading her own words rather than descriptions of them is how much she talks about darkness. Not metaphorical dimness, not gentle dryness that spiritual writers describe as a passing weather pattern of the soul. She describes something thicker, a cognitive fog that interferes with her ability to believe what she once believed without effort. Heaven, she writes, has become a mere word. Think about that sentence for a moment. A cloistered nun whose entire life is organized around the next world admits that the next world has stopped being real to her. Not emotionally distant, conceptually empty. The word remains, but the thing behind it has vanished. Why would anyone preserve that sentence? It seems to undermine the whole point of her, and yet there it is, in her manuscripts, copied out carefully by her sisters after her death. The answer lies in how it was framed. Her doubt was presented not as a conclusion she had reached, but as a cross she was carrying. Suffering she endured for the sake of unbelievers so that they might be saved. a thinker's observation was quietly converted into a saint's sacrifice. This is where it gets interesting. In manuscript B, written to her sister Marie, Thérèse says something remarkable. She doesn't claim to understand atheists in some abstract, sympathetic way. She says she hears them speak within her own mind. Their arguments that death is simply the end, that the darkness is all there is, have become her argument. She admits the evidence seems to point their way. This is not catechism. This is a young woman, coughing blood in a convent cell, conducting an honest epistemological investigation. She's asking, what can I actually know? What does the evidence actually support? She never published these words herself, of course. She was writing for her superiors, and she died before she could see what would be done with them. What was done, mostly, was smoothing. When her writings, that a normal moral person would consider sacred, appeared in hagiography, the original life stories of saints, these passages were reframed as illustrations of heroic endurance. The question they originally posed, what if belief isn't actually supported by experience, was politely set aside. The answer was assumed. The struggle was kept. The doubt was decorative. This kind of move has a long history. Medieval authorities faced similar problems when mystics reported visions that didn't quite fit the official story. The solution, usually, was not to argue with them, but to reinterpret them, to take whatever the mystic said and translate it into something doctrinally manageable. Some mystics refused the translation. Marguerite Perret, a French writer of dazzling theological originality, was burned at the stake in Paris in 1310 because she wouldn't agree that her book meant what the Inquisition said it meant. She had written about the soul becoming so unified with God that ordinary religious rules no longer applied. The church decided this was dangerous. Marguerite declined to revise her position. She was calling us holy. Thérèse got the gentler version of institutional correction. Instead of execution, she received canonization. Instead of suppression, she was simplified. The woman who admitted she couldn't make heaven seem real was turned into a greeting card. That version of Thérèse emphasizes her smallness, the little flower. The phrase appears on holy cards and children's books in the names of parishes across the world. She did use that language herself, but not in the way it's usually deployed. For Thérèse, littleness was a strategy. If you can't know whether your actions matter to eternity, you might as well make them matter right now, in ways you can actually verify. Small acts weren't substitutes for grand ones. They were testable. You could do them. You could see them done. You didn't have to wait for a metaphysical report card. There is a considerable difference between a woman choosing small acts because she's humble and a woman choosing small acts because she's rigorous. The first makes a nice story. The second is philosophy. Consider the passages most often left out of popular editions. Thérèse describes prayer that produces nothing, no consolation, no clarity, not even the comfortable feeling of having done one's duty. Just silence, and the awareness of silence, and the choice to continue. Why pray then? Because, she concluded, action doesn't require metaphysical confirmation. The Church later presented this as obedience purified of self-interest. But read plainly, it is a rejection of the entire transactional model of religion. If God exists, he doesn't operate like a vending machine. Insert prayer, receive grace, check the slot for your reward. And if he doesn't exist, well, the action still happened. It still meant what you meant by it. The human significance remains, whatever the cosmic situation turns out to be later. This is what Thérèse arrived at, on her own, in a provincial convent in the 1890s, while dying of disease that would dissolve her lungs before her 25th birthday. As a side note, today's thinkers also bring this question up. They say that if you are only acting morally for God, then you are not a moral creature. You are, in fact, a fraud who's pretending to be moral. I've heard that argument countless times from great beings. She didn't have access to the existentialists who would make similar arguments a generation later. She never heard of Camus. She was working it out alone, with the materials available, her experience, her honesty, and the willingness to notice when consoling ideas had stopped being there. Here is where her womanhood becomes impossible to ignore. Enclosed religious women in 19th century France were expected to be receptive, to receive grace, to receive instruction, to receive meaning from elsewhere and hold it gratefully. The architecture of the convent, the structure of the vows, the theology of the era, all of it assumed that holiness meant opening yourself to something delivered from above. Thérèse did something different. She documented interiority without guarantee. She didn't wait to be filled. She examined what was already there. When she wrote that the kingdom of God was not experienced as something arriving from the outside, but as a responsibility she discovered within, she wasn't making a mystical claim. She was describing a psychological fact one could verify, one that didn't depend on anyone else's authority to be there. This matters because authority, once relocated inward, becomes very difficult to govern. It becomes the seed of greatness. The men who oversaw her canonization were not fools. They sensed the danger precisely. A saint who obeys because she knows, because heaven is vivid and doctrine is obvious and the whole system makes immediate sense, is manageable. Her obedience confirms the system. But a saint who obeys without knowing, who continues because she chooses to continue, with full awareness that she cannot verify whether any of it is true, that introduces a disturbing precedent. It suggests that the act of choosing might matter more than the thing being chosen. It suggests that freedom, real freedom, the kind that operates without guarantees, might be the actual point. Why did she persist? because she chose to. Choice without certainty is not submission. It's autonomy operating under constraint. Once you see that distinction, you can't unsee it. There is a numerical detail worth pausing on. Thérèse spent roughly the last 18 months of her life in a state of cognitive darkness. A year and a half. Long enough for illusions to collapse. But not long enough for new certainties to form. She died in the middle of her question. This temporal fact explains a great deal. A thinker who finishes her argument is harder to repurpose. You have to contend with what she actually concluded. But a thinker cut off mid-inquiry, before the final sentences are written, she can be compelled by others. Her interpreters can finish her thoughts in whatever direction they prefer. The church did not falsify Thérèse's words, but it did instead was finish her sentences for her. And yet, the unfinished quality is still detectable, if you read carefully. It's like seeing a draft beneath a final painting. Faint lines that didn't quite get covered. Near the end of her life, Thérèse wrote, "I choose all." She didn't specify what all contained. Heaven was no longer vivid to her. Reward was no longer motivating. What remained was simply the decision to act. To continue, to will, to love without leverage. This is not the language of symbols. Symbols are static. They sit still and mean what we tell them to mean. This is the language of someone negotiating freedom under existential pressure. It is philosophy conducted in a dying body, without footnotes, without credentials, without anyone's permission. Reading her this way produces an uncomfortable recognition. Her doubts do not belong safely in the 19th century. They sound too familiar. The darkness she describes is not exotic. It's the same darkness that flickers at the edge of ordinary modern consciousness. The suspicion that meaning isn't built into the universe. That the silence might be all there is. That we are constructing our lives on uncertainty and calling it faith only to feel less alone. Institutions survive by insisting that such experiences are exceptional. Saints feel them, perhaps, or heretics. Not regular people. Regular people believe where they leave. They don't hover in the middle, choosing anyway. Thérèse's buried writings suggest otherwise. They suggest that the crisis of meaning is ordinary, that many people live inside it, quietly, without drama, and that what matters is simply how honestly you do so. The church made her a symbol to contain that ordinariness, to keep it special, to keep it safe. If we let her speak without the shroud, what appears is not a fragile flower. What appears is a disciplined observer of her own consciousness, holding experiences up to the light and refusing to describe it as something it wasn't. She didn't dismantle faith to replace it with rebellion. She dismantled fantasy, the pretty versions, the convenient feelings, the certainties that had stopped being certain. To see what actually remained. What remained was action, chosen freely, without metaphysical leverage, without reward. What remained was love that did not require proof of return. What remained was life constructed day by day on the admission that construction was what she was doing. Perhaps this is why she still unsettles. A woman who discovers that meaning is not delivered, but made, and who proceeds to make it, cannot be safely venerated without dilution. She has to be shrunk, sweetened, made into a little flower. Otherwise, she asks too much of us. She asks us to notice where our choices actually come from. Not from certainty, not from authority, not from metaphysical guarantees. Our choices come from us. The recognition lingers long after the prayer cards are put away. It lingers because it doesn't belong to history. It belongs to anyone honest enough to notice. Grow, grow all the way up until you become a great being.